This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Statio. It's spring, which for many people means love is in the air. But Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist, and he sees things differently from most people. He looks at engagement rings and sees how visual properties influence our decisions. He looks at the buffet table at a wedding and sees patterns of supply and demand. His vision is so unique that he has asked artists to look at research and see art. In February, artists from around the world attended a discussion on social and economic inequality, and then they turned the information into inspiration for new pieces of art. Dan Ariely hosted the discussion with the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke. Dan is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke. He's also the author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, and The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. He joined me in the studio to talk about The Call to Artists, his latest book, and all things irrational. I started the conversation by asking him how he came to study behavioral economics.
It's a very sad story. I was burned when I was 18, very badly, and as a consequence, I got to spend 3 years in hospital. And hospitals are places where you could observe lots and lots of irrational behavior, and many of the observation I had in those early years have kind of fueled my research for a long time. But the starting point of all this was the question of bandage removal. So imagine you were, like me, burned in most of your body, and the nurses had to take your bandages off every day. Now the question is, what's the right way to take it off? Should you rip the bandages quickly, one by one, as fast as possible, trying to minimize the duration but having every second incredibly painful? Or should you take them slowly, very slowly? And it turns out that the nurses believe that the ripping approach is the right approach. I didn't like that approach. And when I got out of the hospital, I did some experiments, not with burn patients, but with other ways of hurting people. And I found that the nurses were wrong. And what struck me about this was the nurses were wrong in a predictable and systematic way. It wasn't as if one nurse was doing it too fast and one was doing it too slow, and if they could only get together and talk to each other, they would get it right. All the nurses had the same bias, and they were getting it wrong for every patient every time.
And certainly we all have, in much less severe cases, we all have this sense of, oh, we'll rip the Band-Aid off fast. That's the best way to do it.
That's right. Band-Aids, by the way, are interesting because you also have hair. There's something about the mechanics of hair. But And I think some of the intuitions of the nurses came up from how they used to wax their legs. I think that's kind of what brought them to the belief. But nevertheless, it's a belief that they held very strongly. Nobody ever said, I don't know what's the best way. They held it very strongly, and they were wrong at the same time. And I think it's... Actually, the more I do research on it, the more thing I find that people hold very strong beliefs about what's the real state of the world, but in fact, they're wrong systematically, predictably, all the time.
I have to ask, in those experiments that you did following that, how were you hurting people in order to test this?
So
who subjects themselves to that?
So in the first set of experiments, I didn't have much money for research. So I went to a hardware store and I got a carpenter's vise, you know, one of those things that you put two pieces of wood together, and I set it up in a lab, and I invited people to come and put two fingers in this vise, and I would crunch their fingers a little bit. And then after I published my first paper, I got more research funding. So I moved to electrical shocks and sounds and people winning and losing money in the stock market, all kinds of other treatments as well. And they all work in the same way. It's kind of interesting if you think about it. All of those experiences, the way we integrate them over time, seem to have some a common element to how we do it, and it's not the quick ripping.
So you're hosting this discussion with the Center for Advanced Hindsight. And first I want to ask, what is the Center for Advanced Hindsight? Because it sounds like something from Monty Python.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. So a lot of time when we present results of our research, people say, oh, yes, I knew it all the time. But of course, people didn't know it all the time. And if we asked them beforehand, they would not be able to do it. But we all have a tremendous ability in hindsight to say, oh, yes, I knew it all the time. Oh, I knew that the market, I knew things were overvalued. I knew it was in the bubble, and so on. So it's a cautionary tale on one hand to remind ourselves and other people that we do think, in hindsight, we're able to see things much differently than we would do the other way around. And advanced, you know, come on, we're at Duke University, we felt like we need an advanced center for something, so we put them together.
Absolutely. No old center for
right,
for hindsight.
Right.
So tell us about the research on inequality.
Yeah, so there's lots of course, saliency now of the level of inequality. The financial crisis, the 99%, the elections, and, you know, the realization of how much money people make is making people kind of look into it more deeply. And there's lots of debates in economics about what's the right level of inequality to have. You know, if you have a flat, everybody has the same amount, like in socialism, you would say people might not be motivated to move forward. So maybe you need some level of inequality. If you have a lot of inequality, at some level it might get too much. So economists worry about the optimal inequality. But we wanted to take a step back and to say, what level of inequality do people want? So imagine we just ask people, what level of inequality, what kind of society would you like to live in? And we drew back on a philosopher called John Rawls. And John Rawls said that a just society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you'd be willing to enter it in a random place. And if you think about it, it's a very beautiful definition. Because if you're very wealthy, you might want the wealthy people to have money and the poor to have very little. If you're very poor, you might want the poor to have more and the wealthy to have less. But if you don't know where you'll be allocated in society, you could be among the poorest or among the richest or anywhere in the middle. Now you have to consider all the alternatives.
You imagine a society in which you would be dropped in and you could be anywhere and you don't
know.
That's
right. That's right. So we asked so far about 20,000 Americans to think about this situation. We didn't tell them about Rawls. We didn't tell them about what he called the veil of ignorance. But we described this idea and we say, what kind of world would you create? And we took the U.S. and we say, imagine there were five buckets. The wealthiest buckets, the next, the next, the next, and the poorest. And first we ask people to tell us what they think is the level of inequality in the U.S. So I'll ask you, if you took the bottom two buckets, the bottom 40% of Americans, how much of the total wealth, 100%, do you think that the bottom 40% own?
I think it's somewhere around 10 to 20% or something.
So, so you're a bit more generous than most people, but we get the answer of around 8 to 10 is very common. The reality is 0.3. So the bottom 40% of Americans, almost half, basically own nothing, whereas the top 20% own 84% of the wealth. So first of all, people don't understand. People don't understand how much the rich have, but then they particularly don't understand how little the poor have.
Clearly, I have just demonstrated this.
That's right. But then we went to the Rawls story, and we say, imagine you're in charge of creating a society that you would definitely go into later on in a random place. What would you choose? Americans create a much more equal society. So I'll give you one example. We showed, in another question, we showed people a distribution of wealth that is more equal than Sweden, dramatically more equal than Sweden. And we showed them a distribution of wealth that is based on the U.S. And we asked them, which one would you enter under the Rawls constraint? 92% of Americans preferred the improved or more equal Sweden. So that's kind of the sad news, right? The sad news has two parts to it. One is we don't understand how unequal the U.S. is. And the second thing is when we ask us what we want a much more equal society. Here's the good news. When we break this 92% prefer the improved Sweden by Republicans and Democrats, for Democrats it's 93%. For Republicans it's 90.5%. Different, but very similar. And the same thing goes for all of our findings, is that when we look at men and women, rich and poor, Republicans and Democrats, we find differences, but they are tiny compared to the gap between what we have and what people say they want to have. And for me, this was initially quite baffling, right? How can it be that we have these seemingly incredible differences in rhetoric on the Republican and Democratic side? And then when we look at what people find just, we actually find such tremendous similarities. And I think it has two roles. The first one is, I think that politicians are trying to obscure the real similarities between us. Politicians are all about telling us that the Republicans are really very different from the Democrats and we're really two very different ideology, and they're kind of obscuring or obfuscating the similarity. The second thing is, I think that the Rawls constraint is almost like doing blind wine tasting. So when you taste wine and you know how much it costs and you see the label, you're going to be influenced by that. And when you have no label and no price, it's just your senses. In the same way, I think the Rawls constraint is the same way. When you are asked to say what you want in terms of taxes, you're influenced by your current state of wealth and your current position and so on. But if you have to imagine the Rawls constraint, all of a sudden you think in a very much more abstract way, general way, and it kind of taps the similarity in human nature. By the way, we also ran this experiment in Australia, and we find that the Americans are not very different from Australians. We ran it with listeners of NPR and with readers of Forbes magazine, presumably very different people, the same result. And we also ran it at Harvard. We took people from different departments at Harvard and we asked them these questions. And with the exception of the people in the business school, everybody was very, very similar. And even the people in the business school, they were just slightly less interested in the poorest. They were giving them slightly less. But even the people from Harvard Business School, in general, created a society that is much, much more equal than the U.S. currently is.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about why you framed this as a call to artists and what's happened with a previous iteration of this in which artists had a chance to create art in response to some of your research. This is The State of Things. We're talking today about irrational behavior with Duke professor Dan Ariely. Just ahead, what is the upside of irrationality? You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Let's return to my conversation with Dan Ariely. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and the author of several books, including The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. In February, he put out a call to artists to create art based on his research into the nature of social and economic inequality. And I asked him why he did that.
So if I think about what I try to do in my daily life is to take a step back and look at human behavior and saying, rather than just assuming that all of this is the right behavior, let's take a step back and think whether people are actually behaving correctly or not. Why are we paying so much for coffee? Why are we doing healthcare the way we do? And basically trying to get initially some insights from myself about what might work and not work and then put it to experimental testing. So I can come up with some theories and say, why does this happen? Why are people paying $3.50 for a cup of coffee? And then I could do some experiments and try to figure out what causes that behavior. Why are people standing in line for an hour to get a free Ben & Jerry's ice cream? Or whatever it is, I take a step back and I try to think about it. And I think artists basically do the same thing. They take different phenomena in life and they basically try to reflect on it. And I was hoping, kind of selfishly, that artists would be able to tell us something new about reflecting of human nature, and then we could maybe test some things together. And the first exhibit, the first test of this we did was related to cheating. So I do lots of research on dishonesty. I tempt people to steal money from me, and I see how much they steal and under what condition, and when they steal more and when they steal less and so on. And I gave a lecture to the artist about dishonesty and asked them to think about their own version of this.
And this was about creative dishonesty, right? This idea that creative people can be more dishonest in some cases?
So we did find that finding, that creativity and dishonesty actually work hand in hand. But the reason is quite interesting. What we find is that very few people are big cheaters, think Madoff, and lots of people are able to cheat a little bit and still feel good about themselves. Hmm. So let's say we've tested about 30,000 people so far in our experiments. We found about 12 people that cheated us to a large degree and stole about $150 from us. Mm-hmm. And we found about 18,000 people who cheated a little bit and stole about $36,000 from us. And I think this is actually a reflection on society where you have a few big cheaters who make the news, but the real economic loss comes from lots of little cheaters, your accountant, your banker, insurance agent. They're just kind of round corners here and there, but at the end of the day, ending costing us much more. And what we found is that this cheating comes from kind of turning a blind eye onto our own behavior. It's as if people are trying to do two things at the same time. We're trying to think of ourselves as honest, wonderful, moral people, and we try to benefit from cheating. Now, you could say, how could you do both? You do one or the other. It turns out that if you cheat just a little bit, you could get both. You could get to benefit a little bit from cheating and still think of yourself as a good person. Now, what happened to creative people? Creative people can just tell better stories. So creative people are able to better cheat and tell themselves a story about why this is actually okay. And I'll tell you just like one thing that came from this exhibit that was very interesting. There was a guy who created a very nice exhibit on cheating at work. Mm-hmm. And he had two versions of it. One version, the whole room was kind of covered with clipboards and notes and so on.
And this is an art installation in response to this research.
That's right. And it was all installed in our office. So we had a nice reception, and we had 20-some installation with different levels of complexity and sophistication. And it was tremendous. But this one artist created all these clipboards that were hanging on the wall. And some of them were about pretending to work, so about people trying to make it look to their bosses that they're working. Mm-hmm. And the other one was about to-do lists. And I actually thought about to-do lists in a very interesting way after seeing this exhibit, that to-do lists might be a way to cheat ourselves, to give us the sense that we're actually making progress. You write 10 items on your to-do list. First of all, you spend some time on the to-do list. You feel you've accomplished something, and then you get to check things out. You feel like you accomplish more. Are there ways in which we basically create a working environment that gives us the fake, false impression that we've actually made some progress? So we're now actually trying to explore this in more detail about what gets people to think and feel that they've made progress separate from real progress itself.
Hmm. And, you know, one of the most fascinating findings that I saw in your research on people, say, cheating or stealing perhaps just a little bit, is this idea of people who would never steal, say, even 10 cents in actual money, are much more willing to steal things that have monetary value but are not actual currency.
That's right. So the little joke is that Jack comes home from school with a note from the teacher that says that little Jack stole a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to him. And Jack's father is furious and said, "Jack, I'm so disappointed and humiliated. You never, never, never steal a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to you. You're grounded for 3 weeks and just wait until your mother comes home. And besides, Jack, you know very well that if you need a pencil, you can just say something. You can just ask and I can bring you dozens of pencils from work." And I think this captures the intuition, and the research show it as well, is that when something is phrased as cash, we have a very hard time stealing it directly. You can't walk by the petty cash box and take a dollar and feel good about yourself, not even 10 cents. But if something is multiple steps removed from money, and you can think about pencils, but you can also think about mortgage-backed securities and stock options and expense reports, on those things that are multiple steps removed from money, people feel much more comfortable both cheating and able to think about themselves in positive, glowing terms at the same time.
Mm. So speaking of such things as mortgage-backed securities, et cetera, at work, your most recent book, The Upside of Irrationality, in the first part of the book is how people defy logic at work. And I know that one of the things that you looked at was bonuses, which, of course, yes, has been a real flashpoint over the last few years. Tell us what you found about that.
Yeah, so the question of bonuses, of course, is do they create higher performance, right? I mean, they're telling us, everybody's telling us that they have to give these high bonuses because otherwise people would not work, and these bonuses are going to get people to work for us in the highest possible way. And is there evidence for that? Well, there's no evidence yet, so we thought, let's try it. So we took a group of people and divided them into three. The first group, we said, if you do well on those six tasks that require cognitive ability and memory and concentration and so on, we'll give you 1 day of salary as a bonus. You do well on half, we'll give you half, a third, 0-0. A second group, we said, if you do well on those six tasks, we'll give you 2 weeks of bonus. 2 weeks of salary as a bonus. You do half, half, third, a third, and so on. And the third group, we said, if you do well on those six tasks, we'll give you 5 months of salary as a bonus. And this was for real. So real money on the line. And we ran this experiment in India when we could afford to pay people 5 months salary. But the money was still real and substantial. And what did we find? We find that there was no difference between the first group and the second group. Increasing the incentive from a 1 day bonus to a 2 week bonus did not increase performance at all. It didn't decrease it or increase it, stayed the same. But for the 5 months bonus condition, performance went down dramatically.
Hmm.
Now, why down? Because it turns out that money has two functions, bonuses. On one hand, it motivates you. If I say, look, I'll give you a lot of money if you'll do something, you'll really want to do it. But money is also a stressor. Okay, so we found in other experiments that if we pay people a lot of money to do stuff that is simple, mechanical, think about jumping, right? If I say, why don't you jump and I'll give you a dollar bonus per jump or $100 per jump or $1,000 per jump. Of course, with more money per jump, you will jump more.
Mm.
But what if it was not about something mechanical that you can easily control? What if it was about creativity and thoughtfulness and memory? We can't flex those muscles. These are not muscles, right? We can't force ourselves into better performance. And instead, what will happen is that part of your brain will be occupied with the amount of money and your performance will get even lower. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. When we started this experiment, we prepaid people. There's a principle in behavioral economics called loss aversion, which is the idea that people hate losing more than they enjoy gaining. So imagine that you came to the experiment, you were in the 5 months bonus condition, and I prepaid you. I gave you all the money, the 5 months bonus condition. You never held so much money in your life. And now I say, if you do well on those tasks, you can keep the money. And if you don't, you'll have to return it. What would happen to those people? Well, we ran it once and the person couldn't do anything. Just failed on everything because the pressure was so high. Then the second person we ran did the same thing. They couldn't do anything. They're trying to focus and concentrate. But of course they couldn't. But then the second person, when it was his turn to pay us back, he turned around and he ran away with all our money and we didn't have the heart to chase him. But I think it tells you very clearly that when we give people these tremendous bonuses, and these are not surprises, these are things that people are counting on, right? People are in the loss aversion condition in Wall Street. People are expecting a salary and they buy houses and cars and send their kids to school, counting at least on some of that money. And now if they don't get it, they're incredibly stressed over it. So I think the role of stress with bonuses is not sufficiently recognized. And I think because of that, bonuses in most cases are actually counterproductive.
You know, there's also this really interesting thing happening, I think, as certainly now as the compensation on Wall Street, at least for the vast majority of folks in the middle on Wall Street, has gone down in recent years. I mean, certainly the people at the very top are still doing fine.
Not just fine. The people at the top are getting more.
Right, right. That there's this, I've heard so many people say, well, now all the smart and creative people are going to go elsewhere because it's not the same compensation, which is seems to me to be such an odd argument, as though there were no other motivation to go and use one's creativity other than a giant bonus.
Yeah. I mean, the logic of the bonus, if you think about it, it's really strange. It's saying, I want you to take a particular path and do your job well, but you don't want to. Right? It basically says you don't want to. And just getting your salary and get to keep your job is not enough. So I'm going to put a huge pile of money in the path. And by you thinking all the time about that money, somehow you will actually perform better on your task. You know, we can argue about how much we should pay people. But there's another question of how much of it should be in bonus versus salary. I think that actually a bonus is a way for people to pretend that there's actually pay for performance, even when there isn't. So if we just took some of these executives and we say we're going to pay them $40 million a year as a flat salary, and their bonus is the fact they can keep their job for the next year, people would be outrageous. I mean, it would be outrage. I mean, $40 million a year, what can they do that is justifying it? Show me, why shouldn't we hire somebody who makes less, not to mention higher bonuses. But when we give a bonus, it sounds as if it's paying for performance. If the company does well, he gets paid. Look, the company did very well. But of course, that's not what really is happening. And these bonuses, I think, are creating lots of negative incentives. It's basically a way to kind of hide away and pretend that this actually has an ideological logic of how we're giving the money away, when in fact we're not. Another way to think about it is that every company has three constituencies. They have the employees, they have the shareholders, and they have the top management. And if you think about it, the profits of the company are going to be divided between those three entities. Some of it will go to shareholders, some of it will go to employees, some of it will go to top management. And now ask yourself, who is deciding how this money is going to be distributed? Well, it's management and the board of directors. But the board of directors is often basically hostage by the management. It's their friends, it's their buddies, it's people that they are. So, you know, no wonder that in the reallocation of company profit, much of it finds its way to the pockets of top management rather than to the other two constituencies.
So the most recent book is called The Upside of Irrationality. Yes. And I want to ask you about one other idea in it, which is the idea of revenge. And then also what the upside then is to irrationality.
Yeah, so I think revenge actually described very clearly both the downsides and the upsides. So imagine that you and I were playing an economic game. and you did not know you were playing with me, you're just kind of playing with somebody else. And you would get $100 and you say, look, you can do two things with these $200. You can either take the money and go home, in which case you'll be $100 richer, or you can send it to the other player. Okay. Now, if you send it to the other player, the money will somehow quadruple on the way. So the other player, player B, will get $400. And now this player B could do one of two things. They could either take the $400 and go home, or they can send you back half of it. Now, what you have to ask yourself is, what is it about the other player? If you knew for sure that the other player will give you the money, you'll send him the money. And if you knew for sure he wouldn't, you wouldn't. Now, rational economic theory would say that nobody would ever give you money away. So what will happen in those conditions? You should not send your money away, and the other person would not return it even if you did.
Right.
So when we run this experiment, it turns out people are nice in economic theory predicts. It turns out there's a good chance that if I gave you this money, you will send it away, and there's a very good chance that the other person will reciprocate. That once that person got the money, they will say, hey, somebody trusted me. Somebody put their future in my hands, and I feel like I need to reciprocate, a favor for a favor, here's the money back. So that's kind of one upside. But here's where revenge comes in. Imagine you send your money away to the other player, and the other player decides not to reciprocate. And I come to you and I say, look, I'm really sorry, the other player decided not to send you back the money, but I'll tell you what, if you want, you can pay me, the bank or the experimenter, and for every dollar you would pay the experimenter would go hunt the other player down and take $2 away from them.
And this is your actual money that you're giving to the experimenter.
That's right. Yeah. So you've lost the $100 you were given, but now you go into your checking account and you can lose more. If you give $10, the other person would lose $20. If you give $50, the other person would lose $100. And now ask yourself whether you would actually spend money for revenge. Now, right now you're sitting here and it's comfortable and, you know, we have coffee and it's all very pleasant and you haven't really experienced revenge. But, you know, think about cases in which somebody just annoyed you. Did you ever get divorced?
No.
No, okay. Think about some other. Have you ever called your cell phone provider?
Yes.
I mean, think about cases to do it. And of course, people spend lots of time and lots of money, and we see this in the experiments, that people are willing to spend lots of money for revenge. And the part of the brain that gets activated when people plot and execute revenge is the part of the brain that is connected to pleasure. Now, this is where revenge both is senseless and sensible. And here's the story. So if you think about this willingness to create revenge, why would you? What's the sense of it? Well, it turns out it does have sense. Imagine that you and I lived on a desert island. And imagine that I had a mango and you wanted my mango. And for some reason, I was not watching my mango and you could come and steal my mango away.
Okay.
If you thought I was just doing a cost-benefit analysis, you would say, hey, I'll take Dan's mango away. I'll run to the other side of the island. Dan would say, oh, it will take me a long time to chase him. I could get a new one, and I would probably just get a new mango. But what if I was revengeful? What if you knew that if you take my mango, I will not sleep and I will not rest? I will hunt you down. No matter where you hide, I will spend days and nights to find you. I will hunt you down, and I'll take my mango back plus your goat or something. Under those conditions, you will not even start with me. Right, so the way to think about it is revenge makes very little sense on an individual level, but revenge is a way to enforce good behavior in society as a whole. In fact, it could be that you would behave badly to another person, and I would be revengeful against you to teach you how to behave nicely in society. So revenge is a very interesting instinct that makes no sense for the individual, but makes a lot of sense for society. Because if we all lived in a society that had lots of revenge, every time you drove over the speed limit, risked a child, did something badly, people would be upset with you and maybe do something bad to you. People would behave very badly. You know, police is a relatively recent function in our history. Revenge is basically a way for everybody around you to be slightly police and for everything bad you would do, for them to take it personally and be willing to exert some effort to get you into line. So it's both strange, but incredibly useful.
And if only it did work on our cell phone providers and we could go and take their mango when...
That's right. This is why they're in New Jersey.
Well, Dan, I really want to thank you for being here. Obviously, so much more to talk about in the latest book, but this has been fascinating. Dan Ariely is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. His most recent book is called The Upside of Irrationality: The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. You can learn more about his work at danariely.com. Ariely is A-R-I-E-L-Y. Up next, Charlotte's own Gigi Dover and The Big Love play live. Stay with us on The State of Things.
Golden November in the air and washing through. Washing